Hello, and we are coming at you live through your ear holes. This is the first podcast for Flight Through Entirety, where we're going to be going through the entire duration of Doctor Who, season by season. And as this is the first podcast, this is episode zero. My name's Brendan, and I will be one of your presenters.
Hello, I'm Nathan.
And I'm Richard, breaking the binary duality by being third, just because we're starting at zero.
Yes, hooray. So, a little bit about what we are going to be doing on this podcast. Today we are going to be looking at the beginnings of Doctor Who, so we'll be looking at the pilot episode, the untransmitted pilot, as well as Mark Gatiss's An Adventure in Space and Time. I believe space comes first before time, is that right? Did I get the title right? Do any of us know?
I never heard. Spain and Time?
Spain and Time. An Adventure in Spain
gloves.
And Time.
Adventure in Gloves of Time.
And then we will be going through Doctor Who season by season after that.
Yes.
Yes.
In its entirety.
In its entirety.
Stay with us. You know you want to.
Yes.
We're not like... Dry and without alcohol. Feel free to start before us.
We haven't had alcohol, but we have had cake.
Yes.
So that's something.
We love the cake.
We are recording this live from the sofa of Reasonable Comfort, Newtown Branch.
Yes.
And to set the scene for you, the coffee table we are recording on is covered in cake crumbs, a William Hartnell action figure, a William Hartnell TARDIS, which I'm told is quite inaccurate, outer scale size-wise. It is not anatomically correct.
No.
And just for some incongruity, some Steed and Mrs. Peel comics based on the Avengers.
The Avengers. It is a faux Noguchi coffee table for people who are fond of the Bleep Your Noguchi coffee table website. We urge you to go and have a look after you've enjoyed this podcast.
I never knew it was faux Noguchi. I never knew it was a faux Noguchi.
All of this will end up on a cutting.
Yeah. We can edit that in post, I think, probably. Yes.
So where we're going to start from is having a look at some extracts from the original pitch documents for Doctor Who. So we're going back roughly to the middle of 1963.
Where were you?
Where were any of us?
None of us was born. Well,
I think
outside time and space, outside. And no adventures had been had so far.
I think my parents were 14, so that's
ew.
That's where
ew.
I that's where I was.
So, where are you getting these from? Is this robbed the BBC?
I've ransacked the BBC. For the lead up to Doctor Who's anniversary last year, the Doctor Who news website actually did a 30-part series on the genesis of Doctor Who, and part of that was looking at some of the original pitch documents.
Did you read that? Did you read it?
I didn't read all of it. I skimmed.
I kind of felt like I ought to be reading it.
Yes.
But I couldn't really bring myself to do it.
So if any writers of that rather wonderful 30-part series
are
listening...
It was great.
Yes.
I didn't miss a word.
Yes.
No.
I didn't miss a word either because I didn't try to read all of them. Now, I just want to first of all relate what the series was originally going to be about and get your opinion on it, gentlemen. It was originally going to be a series called The Troubleshooters with a team of a young man and a young woman and an older man. There was no teenage girl or child because it was believed that they didn't command the attention of anyone older than themselves in the audience. So you had an older scientist, an older man being a man in his late 40s. Was defined as older in the document.
And in real life in those days.
And in real life,
indeed. Most people didn't make it past the 50 line.
That's very true.
It sounds like a mashup of Newman's Avengers pitch that he'd just done with ITV. Do you think that might have been
I think that's
part of the storm of it?
Well, no, I gathered that it was Newman who kind of actually vetoed it and just sort of said that a group of scientists wouldn't really need, you know, the Doctor character to tell them things.
Or indeed young people.
Yeah, no, well, I mean, I gather that was it. They go through the pitch document in the, is it the Origins documentary on the Edge of Destruction DVD?
Yes.
And it seemed that Newman wanted the teenage girl and Newman didn't like the idea of the scientists. He kind of vetoed it. Mm. But it's obviously a place where Doctor Who eventually ends up going. I mean, in the 70s, that's actually pretty much the premise, isn't
Absolutely.
It? You've got, they're not a group of scientists, but it's a sort of troubleshooting group that the Doctor advises and he's a bit older than in his 40s, but he's not the old man that Hartnell is.
It's interesting that they vetoed it because it's still very much the post-war future-looking post-Festival of Britain way of seeing. We're still part of an organisation, we're still Britain, and we have something of an empire, and we're still recognising structure and organisation. But the thing that, well, the reason I reckon that Doctor Who did so well right at the time, I guess we'll get into that in a bit, is that it broke the mould, and it broke it on every single line. It didn't allow for anything except maybe the tradition of C.S. Lewis and Huxley were instrumental in this, of the talented amateur, the man who exists outside of structure and outside of, well, conformity and does his own thing and muddles through. There's a great tradition in British writing, British fantasy writing indeed.
So
that kind of character.
We wouldn't have had anything like that if it had been the Troubleshooters. It would have been UNIT, yeah. And it would have been
the UNIT adventures, yeah. By some other means.
And when you sort of look at TV, English TV in the late 60s, early 70s, there were a succession of series like that, The Persuaders.
Yes, but all on the Rival Network, of course, yes.
All on the Rival Network.
And made for the American market, who were set up for that kind of...
And arguably not as successful as Doctor Who.
Or indeed The Avengers, which they were really trying to get on the back of, since that had done so well in the US.
Yeah, and I think it does come back to what you were saying in that... Part of the appeal of Doctor Who, and certainly part of the appeal of
the Avengers,
most of the Avengers, is you have at least one major character who is not a trained professional
and exists outside of the normative structures. We don't really know who he is, where he's from, who he works for, who he answers to, or most importantly, what he's going to do next.
And that brings us very neatly to the point where, as you alluded to, Nathan, Sidney Newman said, "No, I don't want this. This is safe. This is, I want something risky and out there." And so we then got the famous pitch document, which included characters such as Cliff, Biddy, and Lola McGiven? Lola
all
McGovern?
Played by Una Stubbs and a red double-decker bus.
But that's enough about Irish wild time.
I love
I was referring back to Summer Holiday, Cliff Richard's
yes,
movie.
Sorry.
With the double-decker bus. That went over a cliff, or is that the Young Ones?
That's the Young Ones. They did have a picture of Cliff Richard in the Origins documentary, which
yes, well, that's where Cliff gets his name from.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No.
And then they decided, well, actually, no, Cliff has gone a bit past being popular with teenagers and is now a symbol for being sort of unpopular with teenagers, and people trying to be cool with teenagers will mention Cliff Richard.
Yeah.
So they were still going to call him Cliff for a while and actually have it as a character point that Biddy, later Susan, would kind of
Bitty.
Go, "Oh, you think you're so cool being Cliff. You're not cool. Cliff's not cool anymore." But and then they came to their senses and did
He gets replaced by Ian.
He gets replaced by Ian.
Dances in a very stylish way throughout the show, particularly the Chase episode one.
And you know what? Having been a supervising teacher at a seventh form disco, I have to say that yes, teachers do dance like that at school discos.
But there will be a gif of this accompanying the podcast for your entertainment pleasure.
Something I really wanted to pick up from this pitch document is the secret of Doctor Who. Are we familiar with this gentleman? In his own day, somewhere in our future, he decided to search for a time or for a society or for a physical condition which is ideal. Well, he did share digs with Charles Hawtrey. And having found it to stay there, he stole the machine and set forth on his quest. He is the extension of the scientist who has opted out, but opted farther out than ours can do. One symptom is his hatred for scientists, inventors, improvers. He can get into a rare paddy when faced with a caveman trying to invent the wheel. And this then developed into an idea that the Doctor's, or rather Doctor Who's, ultimate ambition is actually to stop technological progress wherever he sees it, in order that his own future, which is highly compartmentalised and highly mechanised, will never exist.
Yeah, no, it's a terrible idea, isn't it, really? I mean, stealing the TARDIS obviously makes its way into the series a few years later. But again, I remember that Newman's reaction to this was that he didn't want the Doctor to be a reactionary. Do you know what I mean? The Doctor just would have been politically horrifying had that been the case. I mean, I guess there's sort of some sense of, I mean, they say dropping out, so maybe that's a sort of leftist hippie reaction to progress or something, but it just would have made him monstrous, I think.
I think we've got to look at, we're not going to get to the Daleks as a teaser there, kids, for till the next one of these, but we need to look in context of the Bay of Pigs and Kennedy being really the only face against which the Western world was facing off Khrushchev and the bomb. And it was a very real thing. There were kids were hiding behind the sofa, but they weren't doing it behind Doctor Who. They were doing it at the 6 o'clock news, because those bombs were about to go off. And that's certainly what children at school at Susan's age were believing.
So you're saying that the idea of a Doctor Who prevents that kind of future from happening by being a bit of a Luddite?
I'm feeling that where would that have come from, other than saying technology? It was a dual-edged sword very much for Britain at the time. It was they were seeing their way out of economic turpitude, but also seeing where it was spinning out of control.
I guess that you do later in the program get, you know, the Doctor who digs at computers, you know, who says negative things about them. They're, you know, something in the robot about them being sort of
very sophisticated
idiots. Yes. But
you do get that, don't you? Even with Pertwee, but that seems to be once we move into the '70s and you've got the ecological viewpoint that started to come into it.
Doesn't Troughton hate computers in?
Yes, he does. You're absolutely right.
And
right.
Actually, even
Votan.
Even William Hartnell says, in the full first season, which we'll be covering in the next episode, in The Keys of Marinus, he says, "I do not believe machines were made to govern man.
Beautiful.
Machines can set laws, but man has to administer them."
Yeah.
So that, I mean, I think that sort of marries the two ideas of that he's not anti-technology, but he does not want technology taking over every aspect.
Yeah, that's a weird one, isn't it? I mean, we'll get to that next time, but that only gets sort of tacked on the end of episode 6, and they all seem sort of quite happy to reinstate the scary brain
mind
controlling
machine,
computer.
Which, because it's written by Terry Nation, is a brilliant idea.
Do you know, I'm the only person that I've ever met who loves Keys of Marinus to death.
I quite enjoy it. I think it's fun. Anyway, we're getting off topic.
Ahead of ourselves.
As happens with Doctor Who. We're going to be talking about the actual pilot itself now. For those of you who don't know, the first episode of Doctor Who was, in fact, recorded twice. And the first recording, which was beset with technical problems, but also had some very different characterization and performances of its leads, was rejected, re-recorded later. And Richard, I believe you've got some things you want to say on the characterization of Susan in the pilot, because she is very different to what we eventually see.
She and Billy are both very different, aren't they? And at cross purposes. Do you want to talk about the Doctor first, or do you want to talk about Susan?
I think let's go with Susan, because she is the title character.
She is, and she is an unearthly child. But watching it from our perspective and thinking where we are now with however many years since the show's rebooted with Russell T. Davis, when he was brought back the series and called his first episode Rose, he said, "I was never very interested in the character or the role of the Doctor. It was the companion who was significant for me." And that's why my premiere episode is called Rose, not Doctor Who. And we have it right from the beginning. My strong feeling watching this again is that Carol Ann Ford is Russell T. Davis in apotheosis. And Russell, you'd look great in that dress if you're listening now. I'd love to see it. I really felt I was watching a fan. And a fan from our time, not a fan contemporaneous with the production. It's called An Unearthly Child, but it could have also been called A Little Queer. And when I say that, I mean not just the queerness and oddness of Susan herself, but the juxtaposition of her in a story set in the time. She's a fan from now. She's interested in history. She's interested in science, gobbledygook. She's a geek. She's a nerd. She's not a kid of the 60s. They did exist. They just didn't have... We didn't even have the comfort of a word fan back then. I think she would have stood out just as much as any science fiction fan did. She's us watching the show, a box within a box within a box.
You see, I guess when they replace her with Vicky again, you know, spoiler alert for a few episodes.
For those of you who haven't seen that far ahead.
Yeah, sorry. Vicky is very much more contemporaneous, and she's actually more hip.
Which is funny, because her character's from the future.
But she's a Merseybeat girl.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah,
it's sort of a modern characterization. It's kind of saying that we're not going to change that much in 500 years. Teenagers are still going to be these excitable, enthusiastic, plucky young people.
But she's also kind of cool and fashionable. There is the Sandifer line in his review of The Chase where he, you know, she's much hipper than the Beatles. You know, she hears the Beatles. They're playing classical music. You know, she's just much more hip and up to date. But Susan's not like that. I mean, she's just strange. And in the pilot, like, I'm not sure that she's vastly different, like her portrayal is vastly different. But the one scene where it did strike me was the scene where she's trying to persuade the doctor, you know, to let Cliff and Lola go. And rather than the sort of panicky, you know, pleading Susan that we get in the transmitted version, I think she is a little bit more distant and a little bit more alien and a little bit more in control.
In the pilot, most definitely.
Yeah.
In her quasi-futuristic outfit.
Yes, and when Ian and Barbara
push
their way into the TARDIS, the Doctor barely interacts with them at all. Sort of dismisses them. But it's Susan saying things like, you don't know what you've done coming here. It's not fearful. It's, I don't know what's going to happen next. Isn't that exciting?
Yeah, you've broken the fourth wall, kids. Yeah. And the kids are actually the adults now.
Yeah, yeah, you're through the looking glass.
Yeah, now. Yeah, you're in our world, in our fanzine. This is our domain, yeah.
And she only becomes worried and panicky when people start getting hurt. And it's
further down the... When he
electrocutes his hand
on the console.
And it's kind of...
Which is a nice touch, isn't it? It's the first time that you actually get physicality. It's the first time that these people from the real world go through the junkyard, if you like, the junking of old BBC drama and all the tropes that they pass through the portal of security with the word police on the outside into the world of television itself. You're gone inside the TV box now, kids.
Yeah. It's this weird tension of Susan's character in that she is mature and she is intelligent, but there are things she doesn't know, as we've already discovered. She's being playful with Ian and Barbara. You don't know what you've done coming here. I don't know what's going to happen now. But as soon as someone gets hurt, she becomes concerned. And that is a very childlike, I should say, quality. Because, you know, children, it's all fun and games until someone falls over and gets hurt. So she does have this childlike quality, even though she's very confident and self-assured. And then something happens to push her out of her comfort zone. So everyone's been pushed out of their comfort zone so far. Like, the Doctor doesn't want Ian and Barbara there. Ian and Barbara are suddenly in this huge spaceship that they don't understand. Yeah. Susan is the last person who's comfortable, relatively comfortable with the situation. Mm. She's just like, oh, this is a minor irritation. No, it'll be fine because no one will believe what they say. But then suddenly... Oh, wait, no, what, we're taking off, you've electrocuted him, you've hurt him, everyone's knocked out, what the hell is going on?
But in the broadcast version, all of those things and that line, you know, you don't know what you've done coming here, is all delivered in a much more sort of panicky way.
Yeah. As soon as they come in, she's panicking and she's worried. You know, in the transmitted version, you lose that sense of her, what Tom Baker would later do of... not reacting like a human being.
Exactly. It's the beat in the drama where you get, in dramatic speak, where the pause, the beat in the drama where you bring the visual back to reality that these characters actually have feelings and can be hurt. This is where it becomes truly dramatic. It's for real.
Yes.
So do we think that after Newman saw the pilot, he said, you know, no, the girl, she needs to be more stupid?
I think that's the sentiment, but I think he had introduced her to the concept in order that children would have an identification character.
Mm.
And so he kind of said she needs to be more identifiable, and I think it went too far in the other direction. She became identifiable, but also she became someone that I think children would have been watching thinking, oh, I'd be more brave than her.
Yeah.
Which is unfortunate.
I think they watered it down and made it something comfortable and familiar when it wasn't going to be that at all. And, you know, even as early in the Daleks, you can see Carol Ann Ford's performance perhaps separating itself from the centre. She really did appear to be the centre of the show in that first episode.
Yeah. Well, I think it really takes only till episode two when she's having a giant panic because the doctor's gone off for a smoke somewhere. You know what I mean? And she's rolling around on the ground and that kind of thing. I mean, she really, you know, loses it straight away. But there is something very centred and something very kind of alien about her performance in that scene. You know, in a way that we don't really see very much until the Sensorites, probably.
What I found so interesting about Susan is Ian's line when he says she's absolutely brilliant at some things and excruciating at the rest. Now, we're not talking about acting. We're talking about the character and how she plays it. I think she's actually terrific. And the only reason her acting, as some people have criticised Caroline Ford further on, is that she's bored and feels left out and takes it personally. And, you know, they're sensitive people. It's going to come across. You can see Billy doing it later on. I don't think it's purely because of his arteriosclerosis that he starts to fluff his lines. I think it's because he's utterly miserable. If someone's not happy, they're not going to do a good job.
Well, and that's the Adventures in Space and Time take on it, isn't it?
Exactly.
Like, once his friends leave, once Verity and Cliff and Lola are out the door, do you know what I mean?
Cliff and Lola are out the door. Anymore. It's a good point, because Ian follows that up when he talks about the character, about Susan in the classroom, and then he says of himself, "I take things as they come." And I think that's quite an interesting point going to where the series was going to go with these characters. Ian and Barbara represent order, structure, and the Newtonian reason, the universe of absolutes and constants, whereas Susan, drawing away with her Rorschach blot and her little hexagon, is extra dimensionality. She mentions currency and alchemy of change when she talks about the decimal system, or can't we just chuck this red to blue thing and start making acid tabs and hooch juice and get onto something more interesting.
I thought she wanted to make bombs.
She wanted to make acid bombs and go and join Abby Hoffman and try and raise the Pentagon.
In preparation of this podcast, I did wonder how the scene of Susan getting the French Revolution book would be different if it had been Ace.
Oh, what a beautiful idea.
And, you know, you could have had the little radio playing some Kef drum solo.
Mm. I think Susan should have been Ace.
Yes.
Well, I mean, there's a deliberate thing, though, isn't there? She's from London and it's 16 and she doesn't know the decimal system either, of course. Ace doesn't know how many shillings to a pound any more than Susan does. Mm. Actually, in the pilot, not many people know this, but I'm a little bit of a Doctor Who nerd, and it's always annoyed me enormously that the French Revolution book that Ace gets doesn't have a white paper dust cover like the one in the brand in the transmitted version. And I know I'm not alone, but the one in the pilot doesn't have that dust cover either. So my theory is that Ace actually comes from a parallel universe where the pilot is canon.
Oh, that's kind of beautiful.
What do you think?
Yeah, I like that.
I think the pilot has to be canon because drug references abound. We can't forget that the vortex when the TARDIS takes off comes spewing out of Susan's left nostril.
Does it really?
It really does.
And her eyes go poof.
Her eyes go bling. It's an interesting thing again about her that she can't actually focus on anyone in the pilot. Her eyes dart about left to right.
She also gets those strange close-up camera things too, doesn't she? We're deliberately made uncomfortable with her just because she's this giant face in kind of, you know, extreme close-up whenever she kind of appears. Everyone else is in sort of normal medium close-up shots. But Susan's face is there, you know, right in front of her. So I think that, you know, there is that attempt to make her kind of unearthly
and alien, which in those days meant foreign. It's not just the Vidal Sassoon haircut and the Courrèges style dress that she's wearing. The camera technique that you're talking about is very much Godard's of Gene Seberg in A Bouffe de Souffle, or Breathless, just a few years before. I believe that Susan is there to represent the Nouvelle Vague young woman who is very much not of this time, not of our generation, completely different, with a twiggy haircut. And it's all there.
And she likes walking home in the English fog.
In the English fog.
She must be foreign.
She must be. Which, of course, Ian had to stop her saying that because that's a filthy word, foreign.
Well, I mean, they did get rid of that for the broadcast version.
She likes walking
alone in the dark. It's mysterious.
Yes.
It's mysterious. She might need to avoid.
Something
would be so normal,
and therefore unlikely.
That's quite interesting about her physicality is that she only sits down. We only see her sitting down once, aside from the flashbacks when she's in class, and you know, so obviously she's going to be sitting down. And even then, she jumps up. Of course, the decimal system hasn't started yet. She jumps up out of her seat, practically into the camera, and it's a really big moment. The only time she sits down, aside from that, is when she's doing her little Rorschach ink block.
Mm.
She sits down, she's relaxed, and she just sort of starts putting ink on the paper, folds it, and it makes two lines. She then encloses the two lines in a hexagon, and suddenly she's terrified of what she's just done, and sort of scrunches it up. And it's never elaborated as to what she do.
In fact, doesn't the documentary, the Origins documentary, has marginal note from Sidney Newman saying, what the hell does the girl for?
Yeah, what is she doing? But I think it's very interesting that that happens. A, she gets scared by what she's doing, so it's like she's not aware of what she's doing, and it only happens when she relaxes, when she sits down. The rest of the time she's on her feet, she's on her guard. When she lets her guard down, this strange thing happens where she draws a simple shape, which I always have thought represents the TARDIS console.
Oh, beautiful.
With the two lines being the central column. But just, it's kind of like just drawing it, oh my god, if someone finds this, I'm going to be in trouble. And that is mirrored later on, because in the transmitted version, the Doctor says, I can't let them go because they'll tell everyone about us. In the pilot, he says, I can't let them go because they'll tell everyone about the science here and the world isn't ready for it.
Yeah. He's worried about changing time. And doesn't he have examples like giving Napoleon an iPod or something? Like, what is it? I can't remember.
Yes, I think it's a Goon episode, giving Napoleon an inflatable piano.
Yeah, something like that.
It's some sort of unmechanized culture, giving them the steam engine or something like that.
Yes,
Steam engine, for God's sake. It's a giant. Yes, it will
lead to steampunk and ruinous fiction.
And tea. It will lead to tea.
It's a lovely thing that they're referencing. So there's a lot of cleverness in this pilot, I reckon. The notion of the Rorschach test goes back to Jung's writings and the unveiling of the unconscious and the shadow self. Perhaps it's that Susan is also saying, you'll get to see inside my head if they see this. You know, I'm starting to reveal some of them, which means something to her, and of course nothing to us because we can't read it. But you know.
To segue into something about the Doctor, sort of in his first scene when he's talking to Ian and Barbara in the junkyard, something I found very interesting, and I hadn't noticed until I rewatched the pilot to talk about it, is that the bit where he's talking to Ian. Do you think it's reasonable that a young girl would be locked up in there? He takes Ian away from Barbara, and the thing is, up until that point, Barbara's been the one challenging him more. So it's this very odd thing of, you know, 1963, the Avengers has been on, Honor Blackman's been in the Avengers for about a year. So one of the first very strong female characters on British television. It's like the Doctor's kind of going, right, she's the smart one, but he's a man, he's in control. So if I convince him to go, get her, like, not talk to her, I'll talk to him. If he goes, she'll go. Because he seems to kind of go, right, I can't challenge Barbara. She's very feisty. So I'll challenge the man because he seems like an idiot. That was the impression I got from that scene, which is quite subversive. Because, yes, you know, it's the Doctor dismissing a woman, but it's the Doctor dismissing the woman because she's too clever.
Yeah, that's very interesting.
She is too clever. I mean, she's terribly clever. One of the great pleasures last night watching the documentary was just the DVD menu for The Edge of Destruction, which has Barbara calling the Doctor a stupid old man.
Yes.
You know, explaining what he owes them. And she really is just truly spectacular. And the performance is fully formed here. Do you know what I mean? She's instantly superb, even in the pilot.
I'd say she is the one person out of the four of them whose performance does not change.
How do you think Ian changes?
Something I felt watching Adventure in Space and Time is when they've got Ian recording the pilot, he's very stiff and wooden, and I thought that's very unfair. And then watching the pilot, it's like, actually, yeah, William Russell seems very uncomfortable in that pilot recording. He's very muted compared to how he would later perform. Whereas, you know, the Doctor and Susan are brought down a few notches, Ian seems to be brought up a few notches. But Jacqueline Hill is just perfect all perfect the way all through. Just to warn you folks, for the first few episodes of the podcast, you're going to hear a lot of praise for Jacqueline Hill. So if you're if you're not a Barbara fan, how are you still alive?
It's true, he is a bit stiff in his in his first performance. But one of his opening lines is, "We're looking for a young girl."
Yes, and
to which Billy doesn't say, "Well, that's nice and normal, I suppose. I'm like keeping them in this cupboard here." Oh, look, here's one I prepared earlier.
Well, it is funny in that there seems to be this undercurrent throughout the whole thing of, I suppose, child neglect and child mistreatment, because Barbara says,
"Kathy, come home."
Well, that wasn't Kathy come home. No, what year is that? Know. We keep referring to Philip Sandifer's blog on this as well, and there'll be a note. Of course, we
do. So it'll be in the show notes later.
Yes.
And he cites Kathy come home as being as potent a force for radical social change on British media as anything of the time.
I don't think Doctor Who quite reaches those levels of social realism.
Despite
the fact that we have a neglected 16, 15-year-old in a cupboard.
But what Barbara says, which I found very interesting, and I hadn't really listened to the words before, she says to Ian, sort of, "I want to push this whole thing further about her living in a junkyard with her grandfather who doesn't like strangers. But I don't want to get the girl in trouble." And it's like, okay, how would pushing her specialising in history get her in trouble? How would contacting her grandfather get her in trouble? And it's a sort of a slightly sinister undertone. And then they go spying on her. And then, as you say, Richard, she gets locked in a cupboard.
Yes. But we've also got to look at social tropes at the time and structures, and that, you know, a child really didn't have very much say and really didn't have a voice at all. I think Doctor Who is great, and the reason we love it and still do is that it's a palimpsest. It's a cipher for everything else. It can be anything else. You can apply it. You can see it through the window of the TV as a filter for every other production and every other story, and it can go into any other story. Nathan, you said something interesting about it. What was it, Sandifer? TV.
Very similar.
It's so easy to get you too confused. Yeah. But in that, when Billy talks about how the TARDIS works.
That it works via television. It actually strikes me, is that in the pilot? You know, in the broadcast thing, he goes, "You've discovered television, haven't you?" And he explains that that's how the TARDIS works. You can get a small building on television into a small box. And, of course, you know, the title sequence has always been sort of, I mean, it's literally a camera pointing at a TV monitor, and that's how the Doctor travels through time, isn't it? You know, it is the power of television. And that's pretty much what you were saying earlier, I think. Yeah, anyway. Where are we going with that? I don't know. What about the Doctor?
The descriptor I always heard about his performance in the pilot before I first saw it was nasty. And I don't necessarily think he's any nastier in the pilot than he is later. He's colder, certainly, but I'm not sure if I'd use the word nasty.
He's colder. And I think the big difference between the pilot and the transmitted version as far as Hartnell's performance is concerned is that scene where they're confronting him in the junkyard. And in the transmitted version, you know, he's going from object to object. He's picking up a frame and and looking at things and going, you know, and throwing them around and saying, I meant to get that fixed up and stuff. And so he's not really paying attention to Ian and Barbara in that sort of irritating way, and he seems vaguely amused by them.
Yes.
Whereas he's very definitely irritated and angry at them, and like I think that shift, you know, that in the transmitted version he really is the Doctor even as we know him today. You know, he's sort of slightly distracted, he's amused, he's you know, irritating. Whereas the kind of angry, you know, high-handed sort of doctor that we get in the pilot, in that scene at least, is very different from what we eventually end up with, I think.
I think the big difference between what we see with the pilot and Billy's performance further on, and it's also really shown in the Origins, Adventures in Time and Space show, is the difference between Billy's generous detachment of his own feelings in his performance and the role and how he softened it, and how in David Bradley's performance you've got the actor's sensibilities and the actor's performance being very much at the forefront. That's the thing that actually struck me as a bit of a loss or a little bit sad about the Gatiss production, is that we didn't get to see how good and nuanced Billy really was. We just get the one beat, and sure, it's 90 minutes. You've just got to get an idea across. You've got to get the story there. But the subtleties of the Doctor's being able to step back sometimes, be present in others, allow the companions to have the floor, and then come forward radically opposed to the narrative or be a part of it and not actually knowing which way he was going to go, was what made him really interesting and exciting. And I think that really did propel the series. He was very much the outsider at the centre. And so was Susan in the beginning. I think the show really lost something. Perhaps it lost something that really would have made it extraordinary had they just continued with the two of them being allowed to be outside their own narrative. In the end, I guess as it had to be, only the Doctor remained, so everyone else had to follow the tropes of drama and be the mum, the dad, or the teenager.
Really until the mid-70s with Mary Tam, who was allowed to be Doctoress. But even she decided to leave when her character was being watered down.
Exactly. And in fact, the only really naughty actors we've got in it who play with the narrative are Billy, early Susan, and then Tom, and throws it all up in the air.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
And Katie Manning, obviously.
And Verity said, you know, not long before she died, that the only actor who could really, she felt, that replaced Billy was Tom, because he was dangerous. After all the political politeness had gone and she could say what she wanted to say.
So now we move on to our first award for this podcast, which is the Jenny Laird Award for Most Puzzling Creative Choice. I think that one's rather self-explanatory. And for me, it's got to be the question, where was David Whittaker in An Adventure in Space and Time?
Yeah, I think
the greatest omission of all.
I think Gatiss said that he sort of keenly felt the omission of David Whittaker. Like, he acknowledged, I think, publicly that Whittaker deserved to be there, but just said, you know, we're kind of collapsing it. You know, we've got 90 minutes, we can't.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it's not like I blame him personally.
What would Whittaker have been doing?
Whittaker would have been doing, I think, some of the Mervyn Pinfield role.
He wouldn't have just been sitting at a table editing scripts.
Well, even if he...
Huffing something. Did he huff things? Huffing mercury, probably?
Thing is, even if they just had him in two scenes, you know, that would have been better than not having him at all, I think.
Maybe everyone could have mentioned him. He could have been like Poochie. Like, when he's not in the room, everyone could have been saying, "Where's David Whittaker?" That would have been something.
Yes, that would have been much better. And the thing is, the man looks amazing. He looks like Jeff Tracy in human form. He's got this wonderful shock of white hair with black eyebrows. Yeah. He's Alistair Darling.
Yes.
He's a badger.
He's a badger.
But a proper darling.
Can I offer an award?
Yes.
I guess the obvious Jenny Laird Award for Most Puzzling Creative Choice in the pilot and the broadcast thing is Susan's hand movements during the during John Smith of the Common Man. I mean, that is there's unearthly. Do you know what I mean?
That,
but then there's
for
kind
me
of
is
really
also
unbelievable.
Again, it's picking up on what the French were doing, Godard, and then the Nouvelle Vague, and you see that kind of movement is foreign, being alien.
So everyone's doing it?
Well, everyone if they're called Gene Seberg.
Really? So in coffee shops across Paris.
That's the one.
People are sitting there with a baguette in one hand, a string of onions around their neck, and their hand movements doing this sort of little...
We should probably mention that half the wardrobe budget went on, for the homosexuals listening at home, went on Carol Ann Ford's Vidal Sassoon haircut. It was apparently the first wedge, not wedgie, children, the first wedge seen on TV.
And I think we should also say, for anyone worried about the French stereotyping of a necklace of onions, I would like to point out that Nathan did not mention wearing a beret, so we're not about stereotyping.
No, we're not. That would be wrong.
And, of course, the gloriously titled, What Would Stephen Moffat Do? Because I've been thinking to myself, we should look at how Stephen Moffat would approach some of the classic moments in Doctor Who as we look at them going through. And for me, a classic moment is, you could obviously go with walking into the TARDIS, which every subsequent producer has had their way of doing. And I did actually quite enjoy Stephen Moffat's moment where Jenna Louise Coleman says, "It's smaller on the outside."
Yeah,
I thought that was a nice, simple inversion. So I'm going to go for the scene in which Susan, who doesn't want to attract any undue attention to herself, immediately acts very strangely in front of her teacher. "I like walking in the English fog. It's mysterious." So I'm going to say, if Stephen Moffat were in charge of that, that the Susan in that scene is actually from after Susan has left the TARDIS, and she's come back in time in order to get Ian and Barbara interested and pique their curiosity. Susan's actually already left for the day. She doesn't want a book on the bloody French Revolution. She just wants to go home to her space television inside the TARDIS.
To snog a boy.
To snog a boy, perhaps.
Through the space-time visualiser.
Through the space-time visualiser. which they don't have yet. But again, she could have brought... She's nicked the space-time visualiser, which is why we never see it after the chase. She's come back, she's put it in the TARDIS, and then she's gone to Coal Hill School to pique Ian and Barbara's interest, which is why when they turn up at the ship, Susan's like, what are you doing here? I haven't even spoken to you today. Get out of my house.
Right.
So that's what I think Stephen Moffat would do if he were given this script.
Okay. I like it. I think he'd kill Ian.
Yeah.
Repeatedly.
And then bring him back.
Yeah, maybe a couple of times.
Yeah, when he drops the torch, he actually falls over and hits his head.
Yeah, well, maybe Ian's sort of magically pregnant in some way. Would that be a thing as well? Moffat would do that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, I think so. Ian gets pregnant to a caveman.
I can actually see this particular segment of the podcast having a limited future because... it seems to me that Moffat only does about three or four things.
Kill them, get pregnant, right. Cross your own timeline.
That's it.
Something with statues.
I think there's also, the creepy one where the Doctor meets his companion as a little girl.
Yes, yes.
It keeps happening and it creeps me out every time. Mm. Anyway, it's enough about me.
Okay, so I suppose we're coming to the end now, but I'd like to hear, gentlemen, if you have any recommendations for our listeners to go out and experience.
Oh, well, I have to plug my own website, to
be
honest.
What is your website, Nathan?
So it's therandomizer.net, and basically the idea of it is that, say you're planning an evening of watching Doctor Who, well, you could let, quality or entertainment value dictate what story you end up watching, or you could do it completely at random, and that's what the randomizer is for. So all you do is point your browser at therandomizer.net, and it will pick a Doctor Who story for you at random. It's very simple, although it does have a complicated system of preferences, which allows you to exclude certain doctors or make sure it doesn't pick a story that you've seen before, or if you're not keen on loose canon reconstructions, you can get it to pass over stories that don't exist in their entirety. So there you are. That might be the only thing that would ever motivate you to watch, Time Flight or The Dominators, but it exists. And you can follow it on Twitter at DW Randomizer.
Excellent. Just a quick question. Have you added Night of the Doctor to the Paul McGann section?
No.
No. Okay.
It's not canon. It didn't happen.
Shock and horror. The C word has come up. Richard.
I think I've said canon before, actually. I think I'm going to say it a few times in episode.
Yes, but I agreed with you the first time. Richard, do you have anything for the listener?
The randomizer for me every time, because I was constantly young each time I pressed it, although it would only give me Peter Davison stories, so obviously it is being run by Valentine Dial.
I think it's
from a darker universe.
It's been possessed by the Marlis, I think.
That's the one. Certainly.
I think Paddy Kingsland gets royalties whenever you watch a story with one of his jaunty scores.
That would be it.
I do love that.
Apparently you've got an electric shock every time. Anyway, sorry.
Yes, but it's live.
My recommendation in keeping with the theme of the podcast is the pre-series audio adventures featuring Carol Ann Ford. There have been some companion chronicles set before the series. One of them is...
The Beginning?
Is there Quinnus?
There's Quinnus.
In the fourth universe. Quinnus. Do they go there?
Yes, Quinnus in the fourth
Quinnus
universe.
Quinnus Paltrow in the fourth universe.
Written by Mark Platt.
Yep. Wow, is it good?
It's quite good, yes.
Almost as good as Ghostlight.
So there is the beginning.
Shut up, he wrote spare parts.
There is the beginning, which is which does actually tie in with... where we see Billy in The Name of the Doctor. There's even a bit where Susan says, "Grandfather, push me into one of the capsules," and he was outside for an awful long time, and then he reached out and pulled me into a different capsule, because it's that moment where Clara says, "You can take that one, but this one's far more interesting," so it ties in with that.
Such a shame we have to allow all that in.
There is Quinnus in the fourth universe. There's The Alchemists, which is set in 1930s Berlin.
I don't even know how these work. So does Carol Ann Ford do a comedy Billy Hartnell impersonation? Is that what happens?
She does a not bad Billy
Hartnell.
She
really does?
She gets the tone right. More, you know, obviously she can't get a spot on impersonation, but she does get the tone and the mannerisms quite well.
So is it a first-person narrative told from Susan's point of view? I just know nothing about these.
Yes, the Companion Chronicles are a first-person narrative told by the particular companion. What's slightly different is her story in the Destiny of the Doctor range, Hunters of Earth. Actually, it's been a few months since I've listened to it, but I believe she tells
really?
That in...
You don't listen to it every week?
I don't listen to it every week, no. So, yes, pretty much it's her telling the story in first person with one additional voice as well. So The Beginning, for instance, has Terry Molloy as Quadriga Stoyne.
She'll do anything when she really...
he's a Time Lord technician who's inside the TARDIS when they steal it.
Ooh, I think I've heard of this.
Yes,
but spoiler alert.
It's very good. Well, that's the first 5 minutes.
Okay.
So, there you go. And that's on the cover. So...
Okay, all right. Yeah, sorry.
It's all right to mention.
Go mad.
So, yeah, I would recommend those audio adventures. They're about an hour long, so you can listen to them in the car... or on the bus or on the train. I wouldn't recommend listening to them on the bike, as I do sometimes see other cyclists with their headphones in.
Yes,
and they're
no, that's
mad.
An outrage. That's an outrage. Ironing is a good time to listen to these.
Yes, ironing is. I was wondering where we were going by mentioning the word ironing.
it's just a little recommendation for the viewers.
That's absolutely right. Now, as this is a podcast by fans... we would like to hear from you if you've listened to us. We hope that someone has. You can actually find our website, flightthroughentirety.com, and we are going to be having a comment section there. Please write in with any thoughts you have.
Abuse is entirely acceptable.
Abuse is entirely
almost
acceptable.
Almost inevitable, I would think.
Yes, indeed. It's actually how Richard gets through the week.
Yeah, under pseudonyms. Mrs. Mary Whitehouse Red has already written some poems for us, which will be in the next exciting podcast.
Yes, indeed.
Tune in for that.
And if there's any topics or observations you have, or if you disagreed with anything we've said, by all means, leave a comment at flightthroughentirety.com, subscribe to the RSS feed there, and you'll be able to get the podcasts direct to you. We will also be on iTunes, so you can find us that way. So just remember, flightthroughentirety.com. We will have Nathan's Twitter handle there, DWRandomizer, as well as mine, which is Critical Theory, but instead of the second C in critical, it's a Q.
It's not Critical Theory, then.
Well, quite frankly, I'm considering changing it because it's very hard to explain each time I do have to explain it. So it may be something completely... I may regenerate it before the next podcast. This is going to be like audio visuals. Our next podcast will hopefully be out in 1 month's time, and we will be looking at the entirety of William Hartnell's first season. So that is An Unearthly Child through to The Reign of Terror. And, well, who knows, by the time we record it, Marco Polo may have been found in a Mormon basement in Hong Kong or somewhere.
They don't have Mormons in Hong Kong.
You tell that to Deborah Watling. I'm not going to disagree with her. So I'm going to sign off. And I would like to thank Richard and Nathan, who may also like to sign off in their own voices as well.
Well, it's good night from me.
And it's good night from him.
You have been listening to Flight Through Entirety with Nathan Bottomley, Brendan Jones and Richard Stone. Episode 0, A Little Queer, was recorded in Newtown, New South Wales, Australia on Sunday, the 6th of April, 2014. You can find us on our website at flightthroughentirety.com or on Twitter under FTE Podcast. And now, I'm off to walk in the Australian sun. It's mysterious.